At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
Refrigerant charging and service procedures for air conditioning. Now that is Craig Migliaccio's book. He's our guest today, and we're going to talk about refrigerant charging, right? And we're also going to talk about some troubleshooting methods we're going to use to determine if it's actually a charge issue or if it's something else, like a restriction or airflow or something like that. So really good episode, guys. Craig, he's a smart dude. He knows his stuff. He's got a bunch of books out. So if you guys are looking to educate up, go check out Craig's books. They're on Amazon. And we're going to get to this right now, guys. This is the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master. Our new initiative is to allow a Q&A anonymously. The reason for this is because a lot of people don't really like asking questions within their company. They don't want to be looked down upon. So we're doing this anonymously. There's a link to a survey. You're going to click it in the podcast summary. You can ask your question, and we're going to do our best to answer as many questions as possible. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas Uniforms for your blue-collar team. Shirts, pants, jackets, vests, hoodies, the whole collection. All right. Now, if you're looking to up your game in the uniform sector for your blue-collar team, check out cintas.com/HVAC Know-It-All.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. Recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada. Your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC. From storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
All right, Craig, welcome back, man. How you doing?
Thanks for having me, Gary. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, no problem, man. So listen, I have this book in front of me. It's thick, which tells me there's a lot of information in it. And it's called Refrigerant Charging and Service Procedures for Air Conditioning by yourself. And then accompanying that book, I guess, is like a worksheet book, Refrigerant Charging and Service Procedures for Air Conditioning. And that's a workbook. And I perused through that. I opened this book first, actually, without even looking at the title. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of blank spaces in here. What's going on? And then I realized, yes, after you read the first one, you're going to go through and do the workbook so you can kind of get a better understanding, retain the knowledge by writing it down yourself. So I would like to talk to you about the books, yes, in general, but I'd like to talk to you about refrigerant charging because it's something that a lot of technicians have done, maybe not done correctly. Maybe they've overcharged. Maybe they've undercharged. Maybe some technicians have walked up to a unit and think, hey, this is short of gas, when really is maybe a restriction or an airflow problem or something like that. So, I mean, this could come at all angles, this conversation. So where do you want to begin? I'll let you choose where you want to start with this.
So a lot of times, what I like to do is I like to start off with just say an existing system. And before you even think about checking the refrigerant charge, or you suspect it's low in refrigerant, you need to first determine, hey, is there a heat load inside the building? Is it warm enough? And so, unfortunately, to check the refrigerant charge, you got to make sure that there's a heat load and airflow. And so maybe 70 degrees dry bulb inside and 70 degrees outside dry bulb or higher. And of course, that's just a standard regular temperature measurement, but it really has to do with the humidity level in the house. But if you're going to check the air conditioning system, so you first need to make sure there's a heat load that you're going to end up removing. Then you're going to need to determine what metering device do we have. Do we have a piston? Do we have a TXV? You know, is this a single speed or single stage compressor outside, or a two-stage compressor, or is it an inverter system? And so if it's a two-stage system, you're going to end up having to lock that into second stage to check what's called the superheat and the subcooling. If it's a single stage system, then, you know, hey, it's just going to be running at the same stage all the time. Inverter is something different. We'll put that off to the side for now. We'll just talk about these fixed speed systems. So make sure there's a heat load inside the building. Check to see what metering device you have. then you're going to have to basically, I would suggest on a split system that you pull the disconnect outside and then you're going to measure your airflow. That's going to be starting before you even bother putting the quick connect test gauges on or probes on to the ports.
Okay, cool. Now, I want to ask you this because this has been something that I was taught that I've done to try to bring up system pressures on a low ambient day.
Yeah.
What about covering the coil with any sort of material that you have, like a big box that you cut open and then you make flat and putting it around the coil? Let's say it's only 50 degrees outside Fahrenheit, right? It's a low ambient day, but the home still got a little bit of heat inside. It still got a little bit of humidity inside. What do you think of that procedure to bring up your system pressures to check charge? What do you think of that?
Yeah, so what you're suggesting is basically a lot of us technicians, when we're doing preventative maintenance, you know, we work for a company, they're like, hey, we need to do all these preventative maintenances before summertime. And so it's just not warm enough yet. So if you have a heater inside the building, you want to run that, try to bring the heat load up inside the building, or if it's electric strip heating or a heat pump, you need to run it for a little bit, get that heat load up higher than normal. Of course, the humidity level is just not really there, you know, inside the building. And then outside, I prefer using some type of a bag or cover or something like that on the top fan instead of, say, covering the coils, because basically you have saturated refrigerant going through there. You don't want to, like, have part of the coil, like two parts of the coil that have airflow crossing and the other two not. I mean, it kind of just messes up the saturated refrigerant flowing through, but that's okay. You can do that. I prefer, though, with having a charging bag on the top, that you can adjust the airflow coming out of the top of the unit. Some of the outdoor units have a grill that's curved upwards and then turns. And so you can't just put a sheet of plywood on it because you're not blocking enough airflow. But for the flat tops, you can just put a piece of plywood on the top, maybe, you know, just a weight, and then you can slide it over to adjust the high side pressure. And you need to get that, say, up around, say, 90, 95 degree saturated temperature. And then technically, yeah, you could check the refrigerant charge, but you need to be able to do that procedure quickly before you lower the heat load inside the building. You lower the temperature before that indoor coil starts to freeze. Now, this whole procedure is based on the fact that you would have a thermostatic expansion valve inside. It's not necessarily a great idea to try to do this with a piston. It's not going to work out for you very well.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we should cover the types of metering devices we're going to see in charging. I mean, typically we're going to see, like you mentioned, inverter. You said we're going to put that off to the side. So maybe we shouldn't talk about the electronic expansion valve right now here. But generally you're going to see a piston, or you're going to see a TX valve. Is there a difference between the two when we're going to charge up a system?
Yeah, so a thermostatic expansion valve, so that's known as a TEV or TXV. That really we need, if you see that at the indoor coil, then we're going to need to check the refrigerant charge with the subcooling method on the small liquid line on the high side gauge and the temperature on that small liquid line at the outdoor unit. Now, the reason for that is because the thermostatic expansion valve controls what's called the superheat at the indoor coil. So if we had a piston or a fixed orifice, you would need to check the refrigerant charge with the superheat method. And so the thermostatic expansion valve is actually like doing that by itself. And it's doing that because it has a bulb on the suction line, which is the large vapor line that's exiting the indoor coil. So it's measuring a temperature there. And it's measuring a pressure there on that large vapor line. And so then it also has a spring pressure on it. So the TXV operates on three pressures. It's got a bulb pressure, which is the opening force inside the thermostatic expansion valve. And then there's two closing pressures, which are the external equalization pressure, which is the pressure on the suction line, and the spring pressure. And so it's able to like hold the superheat at about, say, 8 to 12 degrees. And so what is actually happening at that indoor coil is you have low pressure, low temperature liquid refrigerant, primarily liquids like 20% flash gas, exiting the metering device. Then it's basically doing a phase change, and that's where the refrigerant's absorbing heat from the air crossing that coil. And then once it completely phase changes from a, say, primarily liquid to then 50-50, 50% liquid, 50% vapor, and then it's completely into the vapor state, the temperature increase of the refrigerant after it does the phase change, where it like basically holds the temperature of the coil steady at, say, we'll just call it like, say, 40 degrees. After that, you're going to have the vapor refrigerants then going to start to be able to increase in temperature. And say the vapor refrigerant exits the indoor coil at, say, 50 degrees. Then you would have a what's called a superheat of 10 degrees. Superheat is the temperature increase of the vapor refrigerant. So the thermostatic expansion valve is monitoring that to make sure that you have an efficient amount of refrigerant flowing through the indoor coil to have an efficient temperature exchange. And so when we check superheat, those available ports are not like really available at the indoor unit. So we measure that at the outdoor unit on the vapor line. I know that was a lot there. But.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, everybody can go back and re-listen to the podcast like four or five times. I mean, that's just the magic of technology these days. So if they don't understand it, they can go back and listen to it a bunch of times. So it's funny because I don't know if you know Jamie Kitchen from Danfoss, but
yes.
He's been on and talked about superheat and subcooling. Basically an episode on superheat and an episode on subcooling. And we did the superheat one a couple of years back, and I've had a lot of people go to me, well, listen, I've listened to that thing on the superheat episode on repeat, just trying to absorb all the information. So,
yeah.
I mean, if you don't feel bad, if all the information that you're trying to learn in this trade doesn't hit you all at once, because it didn't hit me all at once. I mean, I'm sure it didn't hit you all at once,
yeah.
But I mean, I got to bring up something like when I used to try to figure out electrical diagrams, and I'd pull the diagram off the unit, and it was always commercial stuff, so the panels would be huge, so I'd be holding them up, right, put them on top of the rooftop or on the ground, and I'd put my finger on, I know we're getting away from charging, but I just wanted to bring up this aha moment that I would feel that I'd get sometimes. I put my finger on like Y1, there's a call for Y1, why isn't it working? I put my finger on the diagram and follow it, right? And then as I would get to a component, it would be labeled. I'd look at the legend. I would then find it in the unit to figure out what it was. And just by doing this on repeat, I had an aha moment one day. I'm like, damn, this just clicked, right? But it's repetitive. It's repetitive practice and repetitive education that's going to allow that to happen. So, I mean, if you're stuck with refrigerant charging, I mean, your books, this podcast, technicians in the field, people that you trust online that you can go to, just deep dive and get that information. And one day it's going to click for you and you're going to be like, I know how to do this. And you're going to feel like a super tech until one day something's going to hit you in the ass and you're like, oh man, now I feel like now I'm back to square one. Cause sometimes that happens when you have a bad day, but
yeah.
Anyway,
can I share a very similar story?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I didn't go to a tech school, you know, when I started out in the field, I just went to work. And so I was using those slide calculators. And so one day after I was doing this for like 2 years, you know, I had no idea what superheat and subcooling really was. I kept using those slide calculators. Nobody taught me. I didn't know. There was no YouTube videos then. The head of the company, well, the service and installation manager didn't know any better either. And so that's a scary thing, you know, and that, so we're talking like 21 years ago. And so I was using those, and then one day I didn't have them. And I'm like, what in the world am I supposed to do now? And that was for just refrigerant charging. That was just for checking the refrigerant charge. And then I started to remember, oh, how I can do this with the gauges and the PT chart and the temperature, like by myself. And then I started doing that. And so it's a scary thing when you don't know even how to check the refrigerant charge or what superheat and subcooling really is. And so when I'm teaching in a classroom, it's not just a matter of understanding the refrigerant charge level. It's a matter of knowing it so well that you can troubleshoot easily. Kind of like what you're saying, once you know all these things, then you're going to be able to glide through and be able to diagnose something quickly. And of course, you're going to hit these walls, you know, where you realize, oh, I don't know that. And that's going to happen to all of us. It happens to me constantly. And we're just in a constant state of learning. So just invest in yourself.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Okay. So let's get back to this charging thing. And I want to ask you a question. So if we go to a system that is completely lost its charge, it's gone, right? I mean, we might get lucky. There might be a weigh-in on the nameplate. Now, from my experience doing some commercial installs in my previous years back in the day, some of these split systems for large commercial applications, it didn't have a weigh-in because they didn't know how long the pipe run was going to be. right? The pipe run could be 100 feet on the install. It could be 300 feet on the install. So there's no way in on the condenser unit or on the indoor unit. You just had to go through the manual, look at their charging procedures, or you had to do it by superheat, subcooling, potentially using a sight glass if it had a receiver or something like that. So what I want to ask you is two scenarios. You walk up to a machine that's completely out of refrigerant. First, that's the first scenario. And we walk up to a system that is slightly low, maybe 30% low on charge. How do we tackle these two situations? So I get the question all the time, do I trust Press rapid locking system? Well, here's how much I trust it. I installed two Mitsubishi VRF systems, City Multi, right? And I use Press on that. This job is over 2 hours from my house. I'm the only guy that's going to respond to this because I'm the only guy working in my company. If I didn't trust it, I wouldn't put it on a job 2.5 hours from my house and have to respond for a leak. You know what I mean? So I do trust it. Check out Rapid Locking System, guys, for a brazing alternative. If your company's having trouble finding technicians, apprentices, or even helpers, I mean, check out wisehire.com. That is what their platform is designed to do. It's to find and seek out talent and potential. And you can create an ad in a couple of minutes, and there's professionals on the other side that will help optimize those ads for you as well. So check out wisehire.com if you're looking for people to add to your team. Chirp is an automated way to keep in touch with your customer base throughout the year, so we're not losing touch with our customers, right? So we keep top of mind. It integrates with all the major CRM tools like Jobber, like House Call Pro, like Service Titan. We can create campaigns, any campaigns we want, customized, change your filter, Merry Christmas, stuff like that. Hey, your unit is looking a little old there. It's 18, 19 years old. Are you interested in replacing it anytime soon? Might be time to budget, stuff like that. So if you're looking for a way to keep in touch with your customer base, check out chirp.com.
So a system that's almost completely low or completely low. So if you walk up to a system that you know has a R410A in it and you measure a pressure that is much lower than what the saturated temperature is for that, like say it's 70 degrees outside and you're not measuring 70 degrees as a saturated temperature on your after converting the pressure, that would be that the system lost 7/8 of its entire refrigerant charge, or it could be completely flat. You know, so regardless, you're gonna have to recover. If it's a little bit of refrigerant, it's lost about 9/10 of its entire refrigerant charge. If it only lost like half of it, you wouldn't be able to tell by just having the system off and measuring the pressure. But anyway, yeah. So you'd have to recover the rest of the refrigerant that's in there. If it's completely flat, I look at that on a service call. I'm like, all right, you know, because that means I should be able to find the leak real easily. And so once you fix the leak, so you got to use nitrogen pressure, increase the pressure, you know, find the leak, take the pressure out, you know, of the nitrogen and fix it. And so then you're vacuuming, then you do your standing vacuum test, hold the, you know, after you have to pressure test again, after you fix it, then you're going to do your vacuum procedure, standing vacuum test, make sure that you're holding under 500 microns. You're going to break the vacuum with the correct amount of refrigerant from the bottle. And you're going to try to look for a rating plate on the unit. You're going to look up the model number, try to find at least the factory charge that the unit came with, if at all possible. And then you're going to have to add extra for the line set length. There's not going to be a real way for you to gauge this if you cannot find a factory charge on the unit and we're on, like, say, an online search. You're just going to have to put a certain amount of refrigerant in based on your own expertise on that particular size unit. I mean, you're kind of screwed in that scenario to start off with, but then you're going to have to try to start the unit up, and then you're going to be measuring your saturated temperature within the first few minutes. Make sure that stays above 32 degrees after maybe 3-4 minutes. Make sure that there is either a compressor protection device such as an accumulator. And make sure that your superheat, you know, if you don't have an accumulator, you just got to make sure that your superheat, you have something, at least say six degrees or something like that of superheat, which means that the refrigerant coming back to your compressor has fully changed from a saturated refrigerant at the indoor coil into a completely vapor state and is entering the compressor. Because if you overcharge the system, and it doesn't have any superheat, and you don't know how much you had to weigh in because there's no factory charge on the unit, which is a rare scenario. you can then check the refrigerant charge as long as you have some superheat. You can then let it sit for, say, 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, and then you can use the total superheat method if it has a fixed orifice, or you can use the subcooling method with a thermostatic expansion valve. But in the case of just it, where it has a factory charge, you're going to want to weigh in refrigerant from the bottle as a liquid into the liquid line so it doesn't have a chance to flash, you know, when you're breaking the vacuum. You want to weigh in your entire refrigerant charge into the system. And if you know you have a long line set, you can add a little bit more, and then you can just basically turn the system on after that and then adjust the refrigerant charge level from there.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So that kind of covers that. I mean, we start flat. We need to try to find our charge nameplate rating if we can. We're gold. We're sitting pretty, right? But if we can't, like you said, we're gonna have to monitor the superheat and subcooling, depending on what we're using. But even dependent whether it's an orifice or a TXV, I would still be checking both, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Make sure. Yes. Yeah. Just to make sure. Now let's move on to we go to a system and it's lost maybe. It's got like a micro leak in the evaporator, one of those seasonal leaks where you go and like, it looks a little low. You look for a leak. You can't find it because it's so tiny. You put a little refrigerant in it because maybe who knows where the refrigerant went. Maybe somebody's been coming along and putting their gauges on for 5 years doing maintenance and taking a little bit out. But you don't know when you're there. You just can't find the leak because it's so small and maybe you can't get to the point where it's leaking. You add a little bit of refrigerant. But then the next year you come back, it's short again. So there's a micro leak in that system somewhere. But just to get them going, and we want to get this refrigerant charge correct, maybe we want to just get it correct for the next month or so until they can get a replacement. Because this happened to me several times over the last year and a half or so since I've been on my own. You go to a call and it's slightly short, you get them going, and then at the end of the summer, you're replacing the system for them, which happens quite often. A few questions on this. Now, when 410A first came out, because we're dealing with a mixture of refrigerants, right? It was always said, listen, you're going to have some fractionation when it leaks out. If you lose a little bit of charge, you need to pull the full charge and recharge it fresh with fresh refrigerant. That's the way we were all taught when 410A kind of first came out. It was at least the way I was taught anyway by the manufacturers. But I've experimented with this over the years, and adding, you know, a few ounces to an already sort of stable charge that's just a little bit low, it runs fine. What are your thoughts on that, first of all?
So R410A, any type of blend refrigerant, number one, it could have five refrigerants as the component refrigerants.
Yeah, it could. You're right.
And
yep.
A lot of times the leak is in the high pressure side. However, we also know, and if it's in the high pressure side, sometimes it's in the liquid state, you know? So if it's in liquid state, it's already mixed and it's going to leak evenly. If it's in the low pressure side, which is like the evaporator coil, which we know is just like a pain in the rear end. It's like, man, why on the low pressure side are we leaking? Why are we having so many problems with these evaporator coils? But it all has to do with the efficiency and the, you know, how thin they make the tubing and all that type of stuff. Anyway, in reference to R410A, it's going to be okay to go ahead and top off, you know, the R410A. Of course, you're always going to want to try to search for a leak. You want to have confidence in your leak detector, like whatever electronic leak detector you're using, along with the Big Blue or something like that, non-corrosive bubble leak detector. You want to have confidence in that. You're going to have to let the customer know how long you're going to plan to leak check for. But like you said, sometimes the system's not even worth, you know, fixing because of how corroded and how bad looking that evaporator coil is. It's like, we just need to get you through this air conditioning season, then we're going to replace it. So you can top that off with R410A, and guess what? Now the problem with any type of fractionation, sorry.
that's okay. You know, I listened to my podcast I did with the Passarellos from Refrigeration Technologies the other day, and I'm like, did I just say that? Or like, what is wrong with me? And I listened to myself, and I'm like, other people are listening to that. Anyway, it happens to us all, man. So don't worry about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Fractionation, so it's going to lessen that amount by you adding the correct mix back in, because that new refrigerant is coming out of the bottle as a liquid. You're not going to notice that much, you know? So especially if you're just topping off, say, 6 ounces or something like that, in my experience, you're not going to notice any issues with that. You can.
Okay. All right, perfect. So, I mean, if we walk up to the unit, let's say we're charging it at this point, what is the best way to make sure the charge is correct? Because I know in residential, you have a charging charts a lot of the times right on the panel of the unit. In commercial, you might not have a charging chart. In commercial, most of the time you're dealing with a TX valve. You're not dealing with a piston most of the time, like 90% of the time, 99% of the time even. So we're walking up to a system that's slightly short. Let's go about charging this back up. What would your advice be at this point?
So airflow is as important as refrigerant level. Mm-hmm. So you got to make sure that you're going to have, say, somewhere between, say, 350 and, say, 450 CFMs, that's cubic feet per minute, per 12,000 BTUs of heat removal capacity of the system. So you have to make sure that you have the proper airflow. So if you have a high humidity problem in your area, like where we live in New Jersey, then you might want to be setting it for, like, say, 375, maybe 400. If you were in somewhere like Arizona, you know, where it's extremely dry, you could increase the fan speed. Maybe you're at 450 or something like that per ton, where every ton is 12,000 BTUs. So you got to make sure there's a heat load inside the building. You already know there's a thermostatic expansion valve, like you said. You have to just verify that real quick. Then you're going to measure the airflow. And so if you are measuring the airflow with the compressor off, you realize that you're going to have a little bit less airflow when the compressor is on because you'll have a wet coil instead of a dry coil. So that's another
correct
thing. But anyway, once you determine your airflow, and you could use, there's a variety of methods, and it's becoming a little easier over time, and we have new tools coming out and things like that, and there's like 10 methods to measure airflow. I won't bother getting into that right now, because we'll completely on a different page. So then you're going to go ahead and connect. It's best to connect, say, test probes, either compound gauges or digital. Obviously, digital are going to be way better. I would recommend, if you're a seasoned technician, you're not going to be maybe hooking up a manifold gauge set, because we know so much about the contamination issues and the refrigerant hoses and things like that. You could hook up a manifold gauge set, but
can you say it louder for the ones in the back, Craig? Louder for the ones in the back row.
So in reference to the manifold gauge sets and hoses, like, even if you were to use those, when you're done, you have to hook those on the back, and you can't just, like, leave them open in your service truck. It's hot, humid. You're going to have all that humidity. It's going to get into the hoses, into the oil. And then what's going to happen is you connect your gauges, you purge the air when you're connecting on. And then before you disconnect, a lot of times you're allowing the liquid, basically you're going to disconnect the liquid, and you're going to charge that back into the vapor side. So you're not releasing that into the atmosphere. So it's like, when you do that, you're charging, you're putting all of that, like, contaminated oil into the system. And so, like, that's an issue. So for students in the classroom, we would teach them with a manifold maybe first and quick connect test gauges. Then we move over to the digital because they're just way more precise. But I want technicians to think through the process, right, for superheat and subcooling, because when it's automatically calculated for you, it's like having the slide again. And so for a new technician, if they just have like a slide calculator or automatically calculating, they're not going to be able to troubleshoot it very well in the future. Anyway, with all that aside, let's just say we're connecting our digital test probes, right, onto the system. On the vapor side, you're going to have a charging tee, which is only going to add just a little bit, you know, onto the, say, amount of air that would come into the system. You could potentially purge the air out of the little valve core on the side. That one's going to go on the large vapor line. And then you're going to have one that just connects onto the high side, just directly onto it. Then you're going to have your temperature clamps. You're going to put those onto the vapor and the liquid lines. You're going to start the system up. And, oh, one other thing, by the way, there's a lot of technicians going around slapping tools on systems and they're not calibrated, like temperature sensors and stuff like that, like whether it's bead type or anything. And they have no idea. They're in some cases 4 degrees off. Well, 4 degrees is a major problem. So make sure that all of your tools, your temperature tools, are calibrated in 32 degree ice water and that you set them there. Some have a manual set, some have electronic set, and some you have to send back to the manufacturer. So you're going to have to read the instructions on that. And I wish the manufacturers would maybe make that a little bit more prominent, more of an issue, like just state how to do it a little bit more. So anyway, after you make sure that you have a heat load inside the building, you know you have a thermostatic expansion valve, you are connecting on both the high side and the low side, you have temperature clamps on the high side and the low side, then you're going to, and you make sure you have proper airflow, you're going to turn the system on, you got to make sure that it's going to be running for, say, at least 3 minutes before monitoring that vapor side. Of course, you can monitor it the whole time, but you need to make sure that the pressure converted to saturated temperature is above 32 degrees. Remember, we only check pressure to determine what the saturated temperature is. So the saturated, yep. The pressure converted to saturated temperature on the large vapor line is going to tell you the temperature of the refrigerant in the middle of the evaporator coil. The pressure measured on the small liquid line on the high side is going to tell you the pressure converted to saturated temperature is going to tell you the temperature of the saturated refrigerant in the middle of the outdoor coil. So that's the only reason we measure pressure, is to convert it to temperature. You could potentially even do this with just temperature clamps on those areas if there was a method, a way that the manufacturer allowed you to do so, or you could use bead types to avoid this to determine if you are low on refrigerant. If you're going to use Measure Quick, you're going to need to have another temperature clamp over on the discharge of the compressor. You're going to have, you know, you're going to have like an additional 5 more tools connected, which is fine, which is because it gives you a lot more data, right? Mm-hmm, but anyway, let's just go with the basic right here. So then you're going to turn.
Can you hold that thought for 1 minute? Because I want to elaborate on what you said about you're only checking pressure to get your saturated temperature condition. And that is so important because you know how many people have said to me or messaged me and said, hey, I have this unit. What should my pressures be? And I'm like, well, first of all, what kind of refrigerant are you using? Like, for instance, air conditioning, we could have R22 still. It's still out there. We could have 410A. We could have all the different drop-ins for R22. The pressures could be all over the place, but the saturation conditions are usually pretty stable. So throw pressures out the window when you're asking for help. Look at your saturated conditions and tell whoever you're asking for help, okay, my saturated condition on the suction side is 32 degrees and on the high side, it's only 70 degrees. Like my superheat subcooling, all of that needs to go along with it.
Yes.
But not pressures, saturated temperatures.
And anyway, you bring up a good point, and I did not mention this, and I do apologize, but you need to determine what refrigerant's in the system before you connect your probes or your gauges to the system. And if the rating plate is worn off and you can't see what refrigerant's in there, when the system's off, you can measure pressure, convert it to temperature in order to determine if it's R22, which would be a lower pressure, or R410A. But once again, there's a bunch of drop-in refrigerants. And it could be other refrigerants coming up now, which is R32 and R454B. So once again, similar to R410A pressures. But you can also look at the thermostatic expansion valve on the head of that. It might have the refrigerant type that's in the system, yep, and especially at the compressor. So if your rating plate's worn off and you don't know, you can also look at your compressor on the rating plate. It should tell you if it's R22 or R410A, whatever it was designed for. So I apologize for that. But yes, we need to know what refrigerant's in the system before we check the refrigerant charge. So we're going to go ahead and we've turned the system on. It's been about 3 minutes. We want to make sure that we're above 32 degrees. If we are not above 32 degrees and it happens for like another 2 minutes, we're below 32 degrees as our saturated, yep, temperature in the middle of the indoor coil, because we see that on our blue gauge, which is our low side, which is on our large vapor line. If that is the case, we have either low indoor airflow, a liquid line restriction, or we're low on refrigerant charge. And so you can also, you're going to always measure superheat on the low pressure side of the system and subcooling on the high side, regardless of the metering device you have, because it will give you more information on the system. Because like say the thermostatic expansion valve, we're going to measure the refrigerant charge level with the subcooling method on the high side. But if the TXV is restricted, where the bulb was leaked refrigerant out of the TXV, and it's not operating correctly, and it's not holding the superheat correctly, then you might think that our refrigerant charge is good and everything's good. But you have, yeah, to monitor your superheat as well and see like, hey, do I have 14 degrees of superheat or do I not? You know, do I have 10? Do I not? Anyway, mm-hmm, so say 5 minutes has passed. We're, say, around, say, 38 or 42 degree saturated temperature, whatever, and that saturated temperature on the low side blue gauge is dependent on the heat load inside the building. If you have a higher temperature and higher humidity in the building, it will be at a higher saturated temperature because there's more heat in the building. So when you hear people say, I'm targeting, you know, 40 degrees for the saturated temperature, don't do that. So don't adjust the refrigerant charge to try to get the pressure and saturated temperature to a certain thing inside the building. It's going to change. And as the system runs, it's going to lower, you know? Yep. So you can't do that.
So, I mean, you brought up, you said three things. You said low charge, airflow issue, or restriction in the system. Now, we seem to have this, and I'm going to say this, but it's like a pandemic globally that we just automatically assume everything is low on refrigerant charge. I don't know how many calls I've been to in the last year over the past two summers where somebody has gone and just doused refrigerant into the system and it wasn't even the problem. It wasn't low charge at all. Why in your, from your experience, from your standpoint, why do you think so many techs approach the system? They see some pressures that are a little bit low and go, yeah, low on charge. And they just grab their jug of refrigerant and start slamming refrigerant in. Why do you think that is the go-to right now for a lot of techs?
So you might call that almost like one of those generational curse kind of deals where it's just the how to check the refrigerant charge has been passed on from tech to tech to tech. And the tech that's doing the job has not looked on their own via YouTube or web search or seeked out education, and they have no idea what they're doing. So they just measure the pressure and convert it to temperature. And I've seen videos like this online that actually have like a lot of views. And I'm like, oh man, you're like reversing all of our work like that we're doing, you know, to try to educate everybody. And it's a little frustrating. And so, to determine if you have a liquid line restriction or low airflow or low refrigerant charge, you don't have to add a single ounce of refrigerant into the system. You can see it immediately via your readings. And I can go over that with you if you'd like.
Yeah, if you want to go over that quickly, for sure.
So if you have a thermostatic expansion valve and you have, say, the correct amount of subcooling on the rating plate on the outdoor unit, it might be calling for 10 degrees of subcooling. And subcooling is that, and I'll have to get into this a little bit yet too, but the saturated temperature in the middle of the outdoor coil, what happens is during the phase change, it changes from fully, say, vapor. It does a phase change from that all the way to the changing to liquid. So it's going to be able to hold the temperature of the refrigerant in the outdoor coil at a higher temperature than the outdoor air, so that it can reject the heat to the outdoor air. But anyway, once it changes completely into liquid state, it's going to lower in temperature as it's going through the coil tubing. And some people refer to that as like stacking liquid in the outdoor unit coil. But anyway, so you're making passes, lowering the temperature of the liquid refrigerant until it comes out of that liquid port on the outdoor unit. So say it's calling for 10 degrees as a subcooled temperature. So if you have that, by measuring the saturated temperature on the red high side gauge, and you have convert that to a saturated temperature, say it's 90 degrees for R410A, and you measure on the liquid line an actual temperature of 80, you take 90 minus 80, and you're left with 10 degrees of subcooling. It's a temperature decrease of the liquid refrigerant. So if you have that, but yet you have a high superheat, say you measure the pressure on the blue gauge, you convert it to a saturated temperature, and say it is 34 degrees. And then you measure an actual temperature on the large vapor line of, say, 70 degrees. You take 70, it's actually the reverse of the subcooling. You take the temperature on the vapor line minus the converted temperature from the gauge. So 70 minus 34, and you're left with 36 degrees of superheat. So if you have a high superheat, which is, we know that's way high. It's 34 degrees. It should be closer. It should be down lower. If you have a thermostatic expansion valve, it should be somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, 8 to 14. But it's acceptable still maybe if you have 7 to 17 or something like that. If you have high superheat and you correct subcooling, then you have what's called a liquid line restriction. And so that could be the issue. A liquid line restriction could be a clogged filter dryer. It could be a clogged strainer screen right before the thermostatic expansion valve. It could be that the bulb, the head, like the opening force in the TXV has lost refrigerant and it no longer has opening force. It could also be that the TXV pin is stuck due to a gumming effect because of somebody maybe not purging with nitrogen while brazing, and you have all that oxidation flakes on the inside. back when we had a problem with the oxidation and having a gumming effect because there was a reaction with the oil that a compressor manufacturer was using. So it could be all any of those reasons. But the long and short is, here's the good news. If you know it's a liquid line restriction, then what you can do is you can recover the refrigerant, or if it's a split system, you can pump the system down, and you can just fix or replace the TXV. And when you replace the TXV, you're going to replace the strainer screen. And while you're doing that, you're always going to replace the filter dryer anyway. So guess what you just did? You just took care of the problem. Yeah. It's not usually in the distributor tubes that are going to the coil. It's usually not that. If it is a commercial system and maybe you have a solenoid valve, it could also be that as well. So there's a few things that it could be on a liquid restriction type of problem. It could also be, for whatever reason, if somebody left the liquid service valve, like in the partially closed position, that's also another possibility.
Yeah, I've also seen it too, where the subcooling is actually through the roof because the restriction is actually a very bold restriction, where it's restricting most of the system charge, and the subcooling goes way up as well. So system restriction is one that we should be looking for. And if you have a filter dryer, sometimes it's difficult if the filter dryer is really close to the metering device. Yeah. It's difficult sometimes to go across the filter dryer because it's so close to the metering device. And if the metering device has some sort of clog, it can affect your reading at the filter dryer. But if the filter dryer is like outside for some reason, I know we want to put it as close to the metering device as possible indoors to protect it from the weather and that. But if it's sitting by itself on a liquid line that has 3 or 4 feet on either side, you can put your clamps across it and measure across a filter dryer and know very, very, very quickly if it's restricted by. So there's a lot of different rules of thumb on that. Some people say 5 degrees across, some people say 2 degrees across, but I've heard people say that it shouldn't have anything across it whatsoever, and if it starts to creep up even 1 degree across it, you're starting to become restricted. What are your thoughts on that, Craig?
I agree. There is no specific temperature, but most of the ones that I measure are going to be, say, like 0.5 temperature degree or less. But once again, now you're talking about the calibration of your temperature clamps or temperature probes, and so that's a big, big deal. And so you would make sure that they're the same temperature when you're holding them next to each other and you're reading before you even take this measurement. But the more restricted, anytime you have a change in pressure, you're going to have a change in temperature. And so therefore, you don't have to measure pressure, like a pressure drop across it. You can measure a temperature drop across the filter dryer in order to determine, you know, how clogged it is. Yeah, you have a pre-filter in there. You have the desiccant material. You could have activated alumina in there. You could have all of that type of stuff, but it can become clogged. And a lot of times it's clogged, say, at the pre-filter coming into it, restricting even the surface area entering into that filter dryer. So, yeah, it really shouldn't have even 1 PSI of a pressure drop across it.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so we should talk about airflow as being a symptom of lower pressures as well. And I recently tackled this summer. When it comes to airflow, I encountered a problem not too long ago where the customer said they had, it was like a chuck in a truck or something like that, I believe, because he didn't have his information. He didn't know who he was. He was probably moonlighting. He probably worked for somebody and he was doing a side job or something like that, moonlighting, and probably didn't have a lot of experience. But what had happened is I went up to the machine, just over a year, not even a year old yet, because it was in the beginning of the summer. He said last summer it started to freeze up in the tail end of the summer. And apparently the guy that put it in was having problems as well, because he said he was downstairs with the furnace messing around with the airflow settings. So obviously there was an issue there. The guy that installed it couldn't figure it out. I had low superheat and low subcooling, right? And what it was is I was able to, whoever installed the humidifier actually cut the portion of the bypass out underneath the coil. So I pulled that off and I could look up inside. And the duct was, I don't know how big the supply plenum was, but it was like maybe 18 inches, let's say, for example, wide. And the coil might have been only 12 inches wide or something like that. But there was no blank off plates on the side. So a lot of the air was bypassing the coil. It wasn't going through the coil, right? So it was causing me to have these lowered conditions. And I said, listen, it's all got to be... So what I did was I took a blank off plate and I blanked off the biggest side, the biggest opening on the side. And automatically it increased my saturated condition on the suction side from about 32-ish up to about 36 or 37 saturated conditions. And I said, realistically, I need to pull this out and I need to create a proper plate around it in the supply plenum. And he's like, okay, if I have any more problems, I'll call you back. At this point, he didn't want to pay me to fix it properly. He's like, I said, it's working now. It's not working the greatest, but this is the proper way to fix it. And the guy never called me back. So anyway, so that is a condition where airflow was causing low saturated conditions on the suction side. That is a place where somebody might go up to it and go, oh, it's short of charge, and just start pounding refrigerant in. So airflow is a big one. Give me your thoughts on that.
So if it's a thermostatic expansion valve, what could be happening is if you have low airflow, the TXV is still going to try to monitor and hold that superheat steady. So it's automatically going to have that lower saturated temperature on that large vapor line. And so that's one of the conditions, right, is the basically that the refrigerant flowing through the indoor coil is lower than the temperature in which water freezes. And then the humidity in the air crossing the coil gets attracted to the coil, creates frost, and then ice, and ice is over. And so, yep. First of all, that's your first condition. When you have low airflow, you may have correct superheat still. And you might have correct subcooling or slightly low subcooling because you have refrigerant basically at the indoor coil. You have the refrigerant at the outdoor coil. So it may look very similar to almost normal superheat and subcooling, except for the fact that the high side pressure will be lower and the saturated temperature on the high side will be lower because there's no heat load at the indoor coil, right? And then you have your superheat will be correct, but your subcooling will be, your superheat will be, say, normalish. Your subcooling will be normal. Your vapor sat temp will be low. Your liquid sat temp will be low, and you'll have below 32 degrees. Basically, that's all you need to know in order to determine that you're low on airflow. Because if you are low on refrigerant, your subcooling will be low. If you were, if you had a liquid line restriction, you would have a high superheat and a normal to high subcooling. But the fact that you have, say, a slightly correct superheat and slightly correct subcooling, that tells you you're not low on refrigerant. And it tells you don't have a liquid line restriction. So you know you have a low indoor airflow problem. And that's the one when you have a TXV. If you have a fixed orifice, you're going to have basically no superheat because you're just going to still be putting the same amount of refrigerant through into the coil. And you're going to be basically flooding back the compressor with saturated refrigerant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So something to watch for. And the readings that I had on this particular call was low superheat and low subcooling. And the superheat instantly came up as I blocked off one of those sections of the bypass.
So what metering device was on that system? Was that a piston?
You know what?
Sounds like a piston.
I believe it was a piston but I couldn't get the front cover off where it was because the venting was in the way for the furnace. I could only see it from the back, but it had to be a piston as we agree that, as you said, it's going to have lowered superheat with low airflow if it's a piston, right?
Yeah.
Go on.
No, one other thing is like a TXV will try to hold the superheat steady, but if it really has no airflow, like very, very limited, like only 25 or 50% of the airflow it needs, it's still not going to be able to hold it steady. So in that circumstance, it could have still been a TXV because, you know, it might not be able to hold it because it can't shut down enough. Just because there's not any heat to absorb that refrigerant, so it couldn't hold the superheat steady. So that's another scenario as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when it is low on charge, when it actually is low on charge, and we do need to add some, find a leak, obviously, then add some. What are the conditions we're going to see at this point?
So for a system that has a thermostatic expansion valve, if you have a target subcooling posted on the outdoor rating plate of 10 or 8 or 12, let's just go with a rating plate that says 10. If you are measuring too low of a subcooling by basically, let's give you the scenario, which would be, say, the pressure on the small liquid line on the high side is now converted to a saturated temperature in the middle of the outdoor coil of 95 degrees. And then we measure a temperature on the small liquid line of 90 degrees. That would mean that you have 95 minus 90, and you're left with 5 degrees of subcooling. Because it's too low of subcooling, we need to increase the subcooling to have a correct refrigerant charge. So we need to add refrigerant. At the same time, you're going to monitor the low side gauge. And since you have a thermostatic expansion valve, if you have 5 degrees of subcooling, that means that you do have liquid refrigerant entering into the thermostatic expansion valve. So you have a solid column of liquid entering. And you're going to have proper superheat. So say you have, 36 degrees as your saturated temperature. So you measure your pressure in a large vapor line, you convert it to a saturated temperature of 36. And then say on the vapor line, you measure 46 degrees. Okay. Actual temperature. So you take 46 minus 36, you're left with 10 degrees of superheat. So the superheat's right because a TXV can hold it. But you need to increase the efficiency of the system by having more subcooling because you want more of a lower temperature liquid refrigerant basically flowing out of the indoor coil and into the metering device. And so you would add refrigerant into the low side of the system, which is a large vapor line, a little at a time. You would take your R410, if it's R410A on the system, then you would take your R410A bottle, you'd flip it upside down, or if you have a refillable bottle, it would have a dip tube going down into it. So then you just put your hose onto the liquid side. You're going to purge the air out of the hose to the end of the hose. I like to use the hoses that have the manual low loss ball valves. I'd like to use those. And so then you're going to purge the air and you're going to connect that to your charging tee that's on your low pressure side of the system. And the reason for that is that the low pressure side of the system while running will be at a lower pressure than your bottle pressure. The high side will be at a higher pressure than your bottle pressure. If that system was often equalized, the HVAC system was often equalized, it would be at the same pressure as your bottle if they were both in the same environment for, you know, an hour or whatever. So when you open your little ball valve to the charging tee on the low pressure side of the system, you also have to have your scale basically there. And if you some scales have a little port on them so you can isolate the hose and the weight between the refrigerant bottle and the charging tee. But if not, you can actually take that, say, 5-foot hose or whatever, 3-foot, whatever, tuck it slightly underneath of your scale if you're sitting in dirt, you know, with your scale. So what I'm getting at is you're isolating your hose. So you're no longer touching your bottle. You won't hit it. You won't do anything because it'll mess your scale reading up. You're going to zero your scale out, tear it. And then you're just going to use the little ball valve at your charging tee in order to let maybe an ounce of refrigerant in at a time. And you're just going to meter it a little at a time. You're going to slightly open the ball valve for maybe 2 seconds, and then you're going to shut it again because you don't want to flood liquid refrigerant straight into the compressor because where that large vapor port is, it may only be 2 feet more until you reach the compressor. And the compressor is only supposed to have vapor entering. It would be like a person trying to breathe in liquid. It's going to damage it. So you just want to take your time.
So what I was saying in working in commercial for many years and mostly seeing thermostatic expansion valves, when I come across a system that has high superheat and low subcooling, at that point, if the airflow is good, at that point, I know that we're having a low charge issue because we're starving the evaporator because we don't have enough refrigerant and we're not stacking up enough liquid in the liquid line because that metering device is like wide open trying to cool the space. So what are your thoughts on that? Just as a real quick diagnostic, high superheat, low subcooling with a thermostatic expansion valve, low charge.
So that would mean that the TXV, that would mean that you have, if you have a high superheat and you have a TXV, then you are very, very low on subcooling. So you're not even 5 or 6 degrees away from the target subcooling there. You have basically no subcooling. You're very low on refrigerant in that case. So that would also be indicating of a slightly lower refrigerant charge if you have a piston system, because if you do have a solid column of liquid heading into the metering device, it should be able to hold the superheat, you know, maybe even within 17 degrees. But if you're measuring like 25 or 30, you definitely have a problem. But if you measure exactly what you said, you know you are low on refrigerant. Yes, Yes, it's just a matter of how low you are. I think you're extremely low if you have a TXV and you measure that.
Cool. All right, man. So, I mean, we've been here for almost an hour with technical difficulties, and I know you probably have other stuff to do today, but I want you to, we talked about refrigerant charging here today, and your book, and your workbook. Go ahead and just tell us quickly what kind of education we're going to find in these things, because there is so much misinformation out there. There's so much, like you said, you've watched YouTube videos where people are doing things wrong, and there's lots of views, and there's a lot of people out there that are taught the old school way, and they still run the old. I worked with a guy who's probably right now in his early 60s, mid 60s, and I swear he was responsible for killing a number of compressors, because what he would do, go to the unit in the spring, and these are big, massive units, right? And I don't like, and I'm not going to say his name or say who he is, but this is something that's really important, and something that he was dismissing as a technician that didn't want to take things a little bit further. He'd have his hand on the liquid line or the suction line, and he'd be jamming refrigerant in. And then one day it was one of the service managers or one of the managers went out to the site with him, and it was discovered it was a liquid line restriction. It was a clogged filter dryer, right? And these things would go off on high head. They would run hot. Like, I'd been to the site a few times, and he was just jamming refrigerant in every time he went, hand on the suction line, jam it until it gets cold, and it was overcharged, right? These are the things that we need to stop doing. There's so much information out there. There are trainings. There are books like yours. Tell us what you'll find in your book to help us charge systems the correct way.
So this is the issue with a lot of, say, like books when I was teaching in the schools, is they didn't teach the technician how to do their job. That's the problem. Like, they need to have procedures. So we lay out different procedures in that book. So we talk about the theory, but also the procedures. And so that was the thing that frustrated me. Like, man, I need to tell them at least a good way or one way of checking the refrigerant charge or diagnosing and things like that. So anyway, in reference to the book, it is about refrigerants, understanding about refrigerants. It is the refrigeration cycle, because I want technicians to actually be able to imagine the refrigeration cycle on the piece of equipment that they're working on. And some schools, even they use our posters and put them right up above the units. And so the students can imagine and look at it while they're measuring superheat and subcooling. And so it goes over the different hoses and low loss fittings and things like that, charging methods, and even more importantly than all of the base level information, then gets into the troubleshooting and the different issues and the oversized coil that you could have or whatever. It goes over into those types of things. And then it has the different types of components in a system. It goes over static pressure measurements and how to measure the airflow in a system using static pressure, or to determine if you have a troubleshooting problem that's because you have a low indoor airflow. So it goes over things in a way where it will be helpful for somebody that's never even done air conditioning before. So it's got stuff for them, and it also has stuff for the experienced technician. Like I said, all of the troubleshooting charts and things like that we have in there has been the result of like many years of testing in the classroom and like staying late at night and doing experiments and things like that. So my biggest thing, try to make it easily understandable and make it easily digestible. I get a little frustrated, you know, even with our own work, if I think that we need to make some tweaks to make it a little bit easier to digest.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, Craig, this has been great, and I really appreciate your time. And you've sent me some books, and I'm going to peruse them, and I'm going to check them out, and I'm going to let my audience know all about the stuff that's in them. Like today, when I posted when that little thing about the King Valve, it super frustrates me when everybody's like, "Yeah, just the King Valve, the King Valve, the King Valve." And I used to say back in the day, it's not a King Valve, that's just a service valve. But I've kind of stopped now because I don't know. Anyway, I thought I really enjoyed that part of that paragraph that I pointed out on social media.
Yeah,
today.
I saw that.
But anyway,
that's awesome.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And we'll get you on the next one, man, for sure. You're going to come back and we'll talk something else next time.
Appreciate it, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok,
Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.